the finely coiffed mane of silver hair, and the swarthy good looks of a guy who made his living doing Cialis commercials. Mason was pint-sized by comparison, but her severe bangs, ramrod straight back, and sharply tailored business suit seemed to add a few inches of height. Emily Forrester grabbed a chair from against the wall and wheeled it over for Mason, while Singer took a seat at the head of the conference table.
"Sorry I'm late,"
Knox said in a rumbling, low voice. His tone suggested this was the worst possible way to start his day.
"Let me begin by saying this meeting is privileged. No minutes. The reputation of community has to trump the glaring negligence from any member of its staff. So, tell me, Stan, what happened in there?"
Mason managed to get Knox Singer's attention, and she gave him a look he understood.
"Wait," Knox said, preempting Dr. Metcalf's response. "Do you want counsel, Stan? You can have it. Just say the word."
Dr. Metcalf sat stone-faced and issued no response. None was necessary. Everyone knew what this meant. There was no defense. As the attending physician, Dr. Metcalf was responsible for everything that happened in the OR, including the negligent actions of his first assistant. Carrie sat rigid in her chair and felt a tight band pull across her chest. Her throat had gone Sahara dry, but she could not manage even a sip from the glass of ice water in front of her. They might be talking to Dr. Metcalf, but this meeting was about her. She fixed her gaze on her hands, which were clutched together in her lap. She needed to keep it together.
"Got it," Knox said. "So I'll ask again, and pardon my language, but what the fuck happened in there?"
Carrie lifted her head and somehow found the courage to look Knox in the eyes.
"It was my mistake," she said.
Her voice came out in a whisper, so she had to repeat herself, louder.
"I'm the one responsible."
Carrie pursed her lips against a sob, a few tears leaking down. Julie Stafford's nursing instincts kicked in, and she put a comforting arm around Carrie's shaking shoulders. Gently, Julie eased the glass of water closer to Carrie and encouraged her to drink. Carrie couldn't. She was nauseated with grief. Knox appraised Carrie thoughtfully. He bore a sympathetic expression, as did about half of those seated at the table, with Dr. Metcalf being the most notable exception.
"How did this happen, Dr. Bryant?"
Knox asked more mildly. Carrie shook her head slowly, still in shock. On the occasions when Carrie checked her cell phone while driving, she tried to imagine what it would feel like to cause a traffic fatality as a way of weaning herself from the habit. But now she knew. She knew exactly what it felt like. It was a sickening, horrible feeling she would not wish on anybody.
"I put the film up backward," Carrie said, struggling with her voice. "I should have known. I should have." "Mr. Dixon was aphasic. His right side was weaker. He had a right Babinski. All the signs were there to remind me that the problem was in the left hemisphere, but somehow I just forgot. I guess I was tired from my last surgery, but I know that's not an excuse. I know that. I'm so very sorry to everyone involved."
Carrie braved eye contact with everyone at the table, desperate to convey her sincerity. Dr. Metcalf focused on his notepad, as if refusing to look at Carrie somehow separated him from her and her mistake.
"Had you reviewed the film prior?"
asked Sam Stern, the 65-year-old chief of neurosurgery at Community. It was obvious he would try to shift the blame to another department, and radiology was as good a target as any. Carrie swallowed hard.
"I reviewed the MRI with Dr. Nugent the day before the surgery," she said. "I'd seen the films, Sam. I have no excuse."
The silence that followed lasted several seconds before Knox spoke up and broke the spell.
"Julie, what's Mr. Dixon's status?"
Julie Stafford had been head nurse on the neurosurgical floor for 15 years and a staff nurse at Community for 15 years before that. She essentially ran the place. Jokes abounded about her supernatural ability to know everything that happened on her floor, even before it seemed to happen. It was a well-established fact that Nurse Stafford could make or break the career of any resident rotating through 4C with just a few choice words. But she'd always been good to Carrie. They shared the same work ethic and commitment.
"Mr. Dixon is stable," Julie said, "but he's mute and won't follow any commands. Right now, his wife and brother are with him. They know what happened. Dr. Metcalf hasn't been in to see him, though.
Dr. Metcalf shot Julie a stern look. Carla Mason had been quietly taking notes and looked up over her glasses.
I've told him not to, Carla said. I would like to go on record here and say a few words, Julie said.
With a nod, Knox gave his consent, and Julie spoke.
I have worked with Carrie Bryant since the start of her residency, when her responsibilities were limited to doing mostly scut work at all hours of the day. Carrie, more than anyone, took the extra time to get to know her patients and families. I understood that she had been up all night operating on a complicated case. I spoke personally with Beth Stilwell's sister, Amanda, who praised Carrie's kindness and compassion. I've personally seen Dr. Metcalf tear apart residents for any delays that derailed his schedule, so I'm sure that played a role in Carrie rushing to get the OR set up right. Carrie made a terrible mistake. There's no denying that fact. But she's not the only culpable party.
Dr. Metcalf made daggers with his eyes.
I refuse to be intimidated by any doctor on staff, regardless of their stature here, Julie continued. In my opinion, I'm tired of the attending physicians using the hospital like a personal garage whenever a physician friend wanted a favor. Look, I sincerely appreciate our close relationship with White Memorial and the excellent doctors from there who otherwise wouldn't be in a position to care for our cities less fortunate. But perhaps if Dr. Metcalf deigned to venture up to 4C to see his patient before operating, or God forbid, at least look at the MRI prior, none of this would have happened.
A heavy silence ensued, and Carrie felt somewhat vindicated. Better procedures for double-checking should have been in place, and Carrie believed protocols would change as a result.
Look, there's really no issue here, Carla Mason interjected. As chief counsel for community, Carla was directly responsible for malpractice cases like this one. Unfortunately, they seemed to be happening with greater and greater frequency. The majority of these cases were meritless, but the hospital continued to cough up millions in legal fees defending them, not to mention countless hours of deposition, fact-finding, and copying records. The impact on productivity was now just a cost of doing business. For everyone involved, the expense of a lengthy trial was more than a matter of money. It was years of legal wrangling in terms of time, reputation, and emotional well-being. Carla tried to avoid the courtroom whenever possible, even for the most meritless claims, a strategy Knox Singer fully endorsed. The family will sue and the hospital will settle, Carla said. And the sooner this is done, the better. The last thing BCH and Chambers University need is something like this getting out to the press and the public.
Carla and I are meeting with the Dixons at 11, said Emily Forrester, the lawyer for White Memorial. We will advise them to seek counsel immediately. Knox, I take it you'd agree to our informing the family that the hospital and university will offer a very generous settlement and will assume responsibility for any upcoming and future medical care that the Dixons might require. I've already discussed this with Brandon, who concurs.
Brandon Olufsen nodded. As CEO of White Memorial Hospital, he wanted out of this meeting, and quick. Olufsen thought of BCH as nothing more than a cesspool. Three-quarters of the patients were drunks or drugged out. No one had insurance. He could give a crap about Leon Dixon, Carrie believed. All that mattered to Olufsen was that Dr. Metcalf, his choice for the next chief of neurosurgery, was now a potential plague on the reputation of White Memorial Hospital.
So, this Dixon guy, I mean, he was probably going to have problems regardless of any surgery, right?
Olufsen asked. Dr. Metcalf became indignant.
Brandon, Mr. Dixon has a left temporal lobe tumor, most likely an astrocytoma. But of course, we don't know that for certain now. His tumor may be aggressive, and if so, his prognosis wouldn't be very good. Maybe a few years with radiation and chemotherapy. But just maybe this could have been an abscess and potentially curable. The MRI isn't definitive. It can't distinguish between an abscess and a tumor, but we can't operate on the other side until we know what damage we caused by this error.
So, was Mr. Dixon going to be compromised regardless? Olufsen asked.
The tumor might be less aggressive and potentially more amenable to adjunctive treatments than usual, Metcalf said. One never really knows. Mr. Dixon was losing control of his speech. Now we've only added to his deficits. He may never speak another word. He may lose all his memory function. His behavior is likely to be very different. Hell, he could lose functional control of his sphincters for all we know. Bottom line is he will now be functionally dependent for the rest of his life, however long that's going to be. Considerably shorter, I suspect. We can do a simple biopsy of his tumor at some point, but because of the damage we've done, aggressive care won't be of any benefit.
Carla Mason and Emily Forrester took copious notes, but Carrie looked only at her lap. She was finished. She sat silent, holding herself together by remaining as still as possible. But she couldn't stop the tears, which cascaded down her cheeks, dripping into her lap. Once again, Julie put an arm around Carrie to comfort her.
"It's going to be okay, sweetie," Julie whispered. "We'll get through this. I promise." "Carrie, anything else you want to add?"
Knox asked. "Just that I'm tendering my resignation," Carrie said. "Effective immediately." Chapter 7. The First National Bank of Philadelphia occupied the lower level of a 5-story brick building on the corner of 8th Avenue and Sutcliffe. Abington picked it because he was standing near it when inspiration struck. As he expected, he drew suspicious looks from his first step inside. With his flyaway straw-colored hair, haggard face, baggy eyes, and mountain man-style beard, Abington made Nick Nolte's mugshot look like a high school yearbook picture. 4 customers were inside the bank when Abington entered, and none made direct eye contact with him as he crossed the marble floor to the teller windows. Though the bank was not crowded, Abington still had to wait in line, which made him edgy. He was especially mindful of the man to his right, filling out a deposit slip. That guy seemed to not notice Abington at all, which was unusual. Could this guy's obliviousness be an act? Abington's gut told him it was a cop, either undercover or off duty. The brunette behind teller window number 5 motioned Abington forward. For a moment, he contemplated walking out. He felt naked without a hat or sunglasses, and the security cameras had already gotten a clear shot of his face. Oh, what the hell. He was here. She wouldn't know the gun in his back pocket wasn't loaded. She'd give him the money. As Abington approached, the brunette recoiled subtly, her brow creasing and the corners of her mouth turning downward. She maintained an air of professionalism, but her demeanor had turned hard-bitten and judgmental. "May I help you?" she asked in a tone that implied otherwise. Be it a handout, food, booze, whatever it was, she was not there to assist. "I would like some money." Abington was surprised at the shakiness of his voice. He had meant to sound forceful, but instead spoke in a raspy near whisper. The teller rolled her eyes, and Abington took a moment to look over his shoulder at the man filling out the deposit slip. How many checks is that guy cashing? He had to be a cop. Walk away. Head out that door and just walk away. Abington was about to turn around when he flashed on the faces of those bastards pummeling him with bats and steel rods. He pictured the grate where he'd slept the night before. He thought of the many shelters he had called home and felt a pang of hunger. A tide of violence rose in his blood as he thought of the VA that had failed him. He drew his weapon. The color drained from the teller's face. Before she could scream, Abington put his finger to his lip, shielding the piece with his body. "Don't do anything stupid," Abington said, gratified to hear more authority in his voice this time. "Give me the money." From underneath Abington's grimy shirt, he produced an equally soiled paper bag and handed it to the teller. The teller's hand shook as she filled the bag with thick wads of banded cash, but twice she glanced up to look over Abington's shoulder at the man to his back. While the teller filled the bag, Abington counted the seconds in his head. 5? Then 10? How much money had she put in there? Maybe a couple thousand. Maybe a little more. It didn't matter. It wasn't like he'd stopped to count. He needed to get out of there. The teller was reaching for another drawer when Abington realized she was stalling. Her hands were steadier and she seemed less nervous. Maybe she had tripped the silent alarm. Reaching over the counter, Abington ripped the bag from the teller's hand, leaving her with a little piece of brown paper. He swung around, gun in one hand, money in the other, and saw that the man with the deposit slip had snuck up behind him. Mid-40s, with short hair and a square head, the guy trained his weapon, a Glock, on Abington's chest. He shouted, "Freeze, police!" Abington did not hesitate. The Sig Sauer may have been useless without bullets, but Abington had trained with the SEALs and Delta Force. Even out of shape and practice, he was a fine weapon on his own.
Abington dropped his gun and the bag of money and started to raise his hands. No trouble, I surrender.
The officer started to relax, thinking the fight was over. In a fluid motion, Abington grabbed hold of the Glock's barrel with his right hand while latching his left hand onto the officer's left wrist. Without hesitating, Abington pulled the left wrist down toward him at the same instant he pushed on the barrel of the gun. Thrown off balance, the cop stumbled awkwardly, and a fraction of a second later, the Glock had transferred into Abington's hands. Abington swung the gun in a wide arc, clocking the cop on his left temple with the butt of the weapon. Two heavy thuds followed, one after the impact and the other when the cop's limp body crumpled to the floor. Reaching down, Abington retrieved the bag of money and his treasured gun. He sprang up, waving the cop's loaded weapon, shooing the terrified customers back.
"Just leave me alone and nobody gets hurt," Abington shouted.
Outside the bank, the sun's glare punished Abington's corneas. He blinked to clear his vision, but his head was buzzing and he felt lost. What had he done? Jesus, he hadn't made a plan. No figuring out how he might escape. In the distance, Abington heard a steady whine of sirens. They were coming for him. Stupid, stupid. His choices were simple. Run and get caught, or stand in front of the bank and get caught. He looked at the cop's gun. He supposed he had a third choice. Abington put the weapon to his temple, closed his eyes, and conjured up Janine's beautiful face. They had had happy times. He tried to focus on those.
"I'm sorry, baby girl," Abington muttered, thinking of his daughter, Olivia. "I let you down, sweetie. I let you down so bad."
Abington pressed the barrel of the Glock hard against his skin and squeezed the trigger ever so slightly.
Ironic, with all the bullets flying around him in Afghanistan, this would be the one and only time he'd be shot.
Abington took a breath. The squeal of sirens seemed to be coming from all directions.
Can they even identify me? Will they let Mom know I'm dead?
A screech of tires in front of him caused Abington to open his eyes. A windowless cargo van had pulled up, and before it came to a complete stop, a clean-shaven man with short-cropped hair jumped out the passenger side door. He wore a tailored blue suit and approached with hurried steps. The sirens got louder.
"You don't need to do that, Steve," he said. "You made a bad choice here, but we can help. Just get in the van."
As if on cue, the van's rear double doors swung open, inviting Abington to step inside. Abington hesitated.
"Who are you?" he asked. "2 seconds, Steve. We've been watching you and we can help you, but you've got to move, soldier. Now."
Abington's training kicked in, making it difficult to ignore the command. He dashed to the back of the van where two arms reached out from the darkness and hauled him inside. At the same instant, the van pulled away from the curb with another screech of tires and made a quick U-turn. The back doors slammed shut, leaving only slivers of dim light. Steve could not get a clear view of the interior or the person who had helped him aboard. The van straightened out and drove away from the scene at a measured pace meant to appear inconspicuous. He could still hear sirens, but they were heading in the opposite direction.
The interior lights came on, but Abington could not comprehend what he was seeing.
The back of the van was crowded with medical equipment, a stretcher and an IV stand with fluid bags attached, as if this were the rear of an ambulance. The man who had helped him inside wore a surgical mask, head covering, and blue latex gloves. His gray eyes were expressionless.
"Welcome, Steve," the man said from behind his mask. "We've been looking forward to having you."
Steve looked down at the man's gloved hands and saw a needle and syringe. Fast as a cobra strike, the man sank a 2-inch needle deep into Steve's neck and depressed the plunger. A warm feeling swept through Steve's body. He felt lightheaded, a bit dizzy, but also at peace. Finally at peace.
Chapter 8. The town of Hopkinton, Massachusetts, was known, if at all, as the official starting place of the Boston Marathon, but to Carrie, it was simply home. The 4-bedroom Victorian house where she grew up, with its many gabled windows, wraparound porch, and verdant gardens, was still lovingly maintained by Carrie's parents, Howard and Irene, who were now in their 60s and showed no signs of slowing down. Howard Bryan continued to work at Mass General Hospital, and Irene had gone back to school to become a speech pathologist, which had led to her current job at a nearby nursing facility. Carrie's visits were limited mostly to holidays, an occasional birthday dinner, and, of course, marathon weekend, which had turned into a homecoming of sorts for many of her childhood friends. Aside from Facebook, Carrie did not see these buddies on a regular basis, though when they did get together, the night always ended with a promise to do it more often. Carrie drove her beat-up Subaru down the long driveway. In a few more weeks, the tiger lilies would start to sprout and the rest of her mother's gardens would come alive. But right now, the desolate landscape was brown and barren in a way that matched Carrie's mood. She parked in front of the basketball hoop, next to her mother's Volvo, in the pullout to the right of the detached two-car garage, mindful not to block her father in. She stepped out into a chilly afternoon. Spring might have officially arrived, but winter did not seem ready to let go its icy grasp. One of the garage doors was open, and Led Zeppelin blasted from within the darkness. Adam must be in there working on his car, as always. The music was probably coming from the boombox she'd bought to welcome him home. Adam, who'd aced AP biology and gravitated toward STEM subjects, was expected to extend the streak of Bryant doctors that included two of Carrie's grandparents. But to everyone's surprise, he'd enlisted in the Army right after high school. Adam's commitment to the military had ended years ago, but in his mind, the war raged on. Wearing jeans and a fleece jacket over a blue V-neck sweater from Macy's, Carrie wandered into the doorway of the garage, feeling strange not to be dressed in scrubs or sweats. Her brother was bent over the Camaro's open hood, which looked like it was swallowing him. He wiped engine grime from his hands on his already soiled jeans, and only when Carrie cleared her throat did he pull his head out to look her way. Adam's face lit up. "Hey, sweetie." He approached with his arms open wide. "What brings you out here?" Before they hugged, Adam realized he was covered in filth, so he opted for a quick peck on her cheek. "It's good to see you." Carrie looked at her brother's drawn face and hollowed cheeks and tried not to let her worries show. The old Adam was in there somewhere. As she closed her eyes, Carrie could still picture the handsome, sharp-eyed boy she'd look out for back in high school. He still had his wry smile, but the glint in his eyes and that playful, cocky attitude was gone. Adam had cut his hair short again, a throwback to his Army days, and had a whisper of a mustache that was new as well. Carrie did not love the look, but Adam was doing a lot of experimenting, perhaps searching for an outside transformation to make him feel whole inside. The rest of him looked the same. He had a narrow, lean build coupled with a muscular chest, arms, and legs. His pallid complexion called attention to his dark and sunken eyes, reminding Carrie of the drug addicts she used to operate on at BCH. Used to. How could it be over? The thought of never operating again stretched a band around her chest so tight Carrie thought she might stop breathing. She was utterly lost, completely bewildered, and had never been closer to understanding how Adam must feel.
"Mom and Dad didn't tell me you were coming," Adam said.
The garage looked exactly as Carrie had expected, a tale of two personalities. Dad's side, with his beloved BMW 325i, was neat and ordered, just like Howard Bryant. Freestanding shelves kept clutter to a minimum. Beloved tools were carefully organized on several wood pegboards. Adam's side was like a teenager's bedroom. Tools were scattered everywhere, and the workbench and shelves were covered in oily rags, greasy papers, and indiscriminate mounds of car parts. "Mom and Dad don't know I'm coming," Carrie said. Adam gave Carrie a conspiratorial look.
"Everything all right?"
Carrie nodded her head vigorously and tightened her lips. "Yeah, it's fine. Change the subject. Prevent the waterworks. Hey, the car is looking really good." Adam's answer was to stand a little taller. His mouth crested upward as he turned to face the Camaro. He set his hands on his hips and paused to relish his accomplishment.
"It's coming along, huh?"
The Camaro had shown up 6 weeks after Adam left his warrior transition unit, WTC in military parlance, without any definitive cure. He re-entered civilian life directionless, with empty, fidgety hands. Fixing up a car that reminded him of his carefree high school days seemed like a good idea, though their parents were not as certain when they saw the mound of scrap towed to their garage. The car sat untouched for a long while, until one day when Adam's inspiration inexplicably kicked in.
Now that the body was fixed up and a fresh coat of red paint had been applied, it looked truly special. If only Adam could be fixed up with some elbow grease and determination. The WTC had begun as an army unit, but a deluge of wounded warriors from two wars had necessitated a rapid expansion. War recovery had become a major cost for the military's budget, and now close to 40 of these transition units were fanned out across the country, helping soldiers to heal. Still, they couldn't guarantee Adam would leave his program with a cure. 4 years and four different therapists later, Adam had his Camaro and not much else.
"Want to hear it purr?" Adam asked.
Carrie gave Adam two wiggly thumbs up, anything for her beloved brother. Adam got settled behind the wheel and caressed the dash as if it were a stallion he needed to calm before mounting. He put the key in the ignition and gave it a turn. The engine sputtered, but then it just started to click, a series of loud clicks like the countdown of a bomb. Click, click, click. He turned the key again. Click, click, click. Adam's forehead wrinkled in a scowl. Darkness radiated from him as he slammed his fists against the steering wheel and yelled, "Fuck!" so loud Carrie flinched. His inner storm flared, and he continued to pound the car with his fists, the seat, the steering wheel, the dashboard. Adam flung open the car door and stumbled out with a look of madness. His face was red with rage. Adam scrounged on the ground and came up holding a large, rusty wrench. No, Adam, no! There was no stopping him. Adam brought the wrench down on the side mirror, snapping it clean off with a single strike and sending it to the concrete floor with a clatter. Next, he went after the passenger window, shattering it before falling to his knees, breathing hard, spent from his tirade. Carrie knelt beside him, blanketing him in her arms. She rocked him as he wept, his body shaking.
"I'm sorry. I just lost it. I'm sorry, Carrie. I don't know why I got so angry. I just snapped."
"It's okay. It's okay, Adam," Carrie said. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for everything you're going through." Carrie held her brother while he wept. She did not see or hear her father enter the garage, but when she turned, he was there. For his age, Howard Bryant was exceedingly thin, almost rubbery, with long arms and legs that Carrie was fortunate to have inherited. He wore khakis and his trademark plaid shirt with a sweater vest. Just the sight of him filled Carrie with relief.
"Hi, sweetheart," Howard said from the entrance to the garage.
His voice came out raspy, a little aged, but it was soothing in a way only a daddy could speak to a daughter. Carrie held on to Adam. She was not ready to let go, and he still needed her. Howard looked worried, but unsurprised.
"Come on in the house when you're ready," Howard said. "Your mother's made soup. I'll heat you up a bowl."
Chapter 9. David Hoffman, eyes still closed, stretched out on his futon and sent the stack of papers at his feet fluttering to the hardwood floor. His orange tabby, Basra, perched placidly on his chest, undisturbed by the movement. David waited a few seconds, enjoying the special peace of an afternoon nap. Before he drifted back to sleep, David opened his eyes and checked the time on his phone. It was deadline day, which meant Annika would be calling. He was fine with blowing her off again, but he could not sound half asleep while doing it. Something about lying on that futon, especially when the fabric was warm from the sun, was like mainlining melatonin. The report he'd been reading was of no help either. While the Institute of American Medicine was an upstanding organization, their take on PTSD in the military was all jargon and imperiousness. $48 down the drain. Annika would not be pleased. David could have written in a paragraph what the IAM took 60 pages to convey.
"Good on you, DOD and VA, for trying to fix this mess. Bad on you because PTSD in the military is getting worse and you have no ability to track the outcomes."
David turned his head toward the window and the view, unobstructed by the greenery that would develop with spring. The apartment, though small, felt roomy, and an unobtrusive tree branch was a fine trade-off for cheap rent in Porter Square.
Boss rung me out, and David responded with a gentle scratch between her ears. The cat, a rescue, was named after ancient ruins in Syria. The name reminded David of one of many spectacular sites he had visited as a journalist, and an aspect of his career he missed. Having spent the majority of his professional life chasing political strife, David had become addicted to the rush. Nothing could match the intensity of covering an angry mob, of documenting people's most visceral passion for freedom and security. For someone who'd smoked marijuana only a couple of times and who was rendered tipsy by a single scotch, political upheaval was a different sort of drug, and David missed the high. While some of David's classmates from Columbia embedded with a military unit only to up their profile with a newspaper or network, David honestly enjoyed dangerous assignments, though he preferred politics to platoons. A knock on the door pushed David to get up. Meowing in protest, Basra leapt off David's chest and landed noiselessly on the hardwood floor. David ambled over to his front door. "Who is it?" he called, knowing full well.
"David, it's Emma."
David opened the door, grinning. He suspected his bushy brown hair was standing up like a chia pet, and he was dressed abysmally in gray sweats and a blue t-shirt, but he was uninhibited with Emma. She had started out as his landlord, became his friend, and then briefly his lover, until both decided that friends was where they belonged. Now he loved her in a way that would have been difficult had they still been dating. Emma was holding Gabby, a delightful 4-year-old, in her arms. Gabby had cheeks to cause a chipmunk envy, and 2 animated big brown eyes. Her shoulder-length blonde hair was tied into pigtails. Gabby's whole body squirmed excitedly when she saw David.
"Hi, Uncle David."
David warmed every time she called him that. Emma handed Gabby to him, and the little girl squealed and kicked as David tickled under her chin. Whenever Gabby laughed, a sweet high-pitched chuckle, the world stopped turning.
"Who's gotten so much bigger since the last time I saw you?"
He could not resist speaking to her in a high-pitched voice.
"David, you ate breakfast with us this morning."
"Kids develop quickly these days."
"Can I play with the toys?"
Gabby whirled her legs instead of asking to be put down.
"You know the spot," David said.
As soon as he set her on the floor, Gabby bounded over to a corner featuring a playmat and a bunch of toys, blocks, Thomas trains, and enough plastic animals to recreate the San Diego Zoo in miniature. Emma did not remove her own brown tweed coat and wool hat, which let David know she would not be staying.
"She sure does like coming up here."
"And I like having her here," David said.
Emma got a wistful look as she watched Gabby playing with the toys.
"No offense," she said in a quiet, almost conspiratorial tone, "but it would be nice if once in a while she got to visit with her father instead of her surrogate dad."
"None taken," David said, "and it would be nice if her father hadn't moved to California for work."
David put air quotes around the word work, in this case a euphemism for girlfriend, the real reason Emma's ex had left them.
"He Skypes with her, just so you know," Emma said.
Emma could not resist the compulsion to defend the father of her only child. David squeezed Emma's hand.
"I'm sure he loves her," David said.
Emma and the ex owned a yellow clapboard 2-family home within walking distance of some of the best shopping in Cambridge. They lived on the ground floor, and David rented the apartment above. The ex had moved out 3 months after David moved in, and Emma turned to her new upstairs tenant as a lifeline. With long strawberry blonde hair, high cheekbones, and a full, sensuous mouth, Emma O'Donnell was by anybody's measure a stunning woman. But David was not all about looks, and they knew after a month of romance that the chemistry was not there.
"Could you watch her for an hour while I run to the market?"
"Nothing in life would bring me more joy," David said.
Emma looked at him with suspicion.
"Really? Is it inconvenient?"
David's grin only broadened.
"Your needs are my needs, darling. Just pick me up something for dinner, preferably a food item that won't make me gassy."
At 32, David was still tall and lean, close to his high school weight, and could eat just about anything, to the dismay of his many envious friends.
"Too bad," Emma said. "We're having burritos."
David turned Emma around and gave her a playful nudge out.
"Gabby and I are going to work on our Middle Eastern geography while you're gone. Prepare to retrieve a genius upon return."
Gabby overheard her name and came running.
Can we look at the pictures, Uncle David?
Look, she's already a genius, Emma said with more than a dash of pride. She heard you say geography and thought of your pictures. David had read somewhere that kids, especially the young ones, love repetition. In a world where so much was new and varied, seeing the same things over again must feel comforting. His walls were adorned with framed photos he had taken, and showing them to Gabby gave him pleasure as well. The pleasure of revisiting memories. The themes, however, were decidedly adult, and it took great concentration to explain them to the child without inducing nightmares.
What's this one? Gabby asked.
The photograph taken a month before former President Morsi was forced out of office showed a sea of people waving Egyptian flags and holding pictures of the Muslim Brotherhood candidate. The Guardian had paid David $2,000 for the story, but they went with an AP photo instead of his.
That's in Egypt, David said. The city of Cairo.
David carried Gabby over to the world map tacked to his wall and pointed to the country.
Why are they waving flags? Gabby asked.
They wanted a new leader.
Did they get one?
Oh, yes, David said. They got one, all right.
Gabby wrapped her arms around David's neck with python force and pointed to the picture on the wall behind him. She always went in the same order, though David varied his explanations.
What's that one?
It was one of his favorites, a black-and-white image of a riot in Tripoli, right after Gaddafi loyalists managed to kill the rebel leader, Abdel Fattah Yunus. The New York Times had paid $500 for the photo and $3,000 for his story. It had been a good afternoon.
That's a bunch of people acting very excited, David said.
Why are they excited? Did they get new toys?
David loved the way she said toys. Her enthusiasm was contagious.
No, not new toys. They just needed to jump around and yell a lot. Sometimes grown-ups do those things.
What about that one?
First, David brought her over to the wall map and pointed to Libya, the location of the last image. She touched the same spot as he did and then rubbed her hands all over Europe.
Libya, David said.
Libya,
Gabby repeated, then pointed to the image showing thousands of red-shirted populist supporters of Thailand's ousted Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra.
Are they excited about the same things?
Well, not exactly, David said.
How come they're all wearing the same color shirt?
Because they believe in the same things, David said. They're a group.
What group do you belong to?
I don't, David said. I work for myself.
David was a stringer. He had built his career working as a freelancer, foregoing a regular salary in exchange for the opportunity to cover stories that actually interested him. Most of the time, that interest took him to places the State Department was advising Americans to avoid. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. A journalistic tumbleweed, he would probably still be in some red-flagged country had he not been kidnapped. It was not a terrible ordeal, nor was it an experience he would willingly relive. The opposition forces in Syria had decided that David was part of Assad's regime and, without judge or jury, took him prisoner. For 3 weeks, David lived in a windowless concrete room and had no contact with the outside world. Eventually, he befriended a guard who was looking to learn English. With the guard's help, David was able to contact the State Department. A contact at The Current, technically David's employer, spoke by satellite phone to the opposition forces holding him hostage. The editor managed to convince those in charge that David was in the country on assignment and that David's reporting could be of help to their cause back in the United States. A few hours later, they let David go. And the next day, he was on a plane headed home. Somebody else would have to help the rebels' crusade. Word of David's ordeal spread quickly to all the people who regularly hired him for stringer jobs. In just a few weeks, David's greatest asset, his willingness to put himself in harm's way to get the story, became his biggest liability. Nobody wanted to bail Cowboy Dave out of any more international hot water, and suddenly the only work he could drum up was for local newspapers like the Lowell Observer. A reporter buddy hooked David up with Annika, a respected editor, who had dialed her career down in exchange for some of her remaining stomach lining. Though he was grateful for the work, a feel-good piece about a Marine conquering his PTSD was not his dream assignment.
Are you gonna join a group? Gabby asked.
David's cell phone buzzed. Annika. That might be us to leave another group, David said, setting Gabby down on the floor. Go play for a bit. I have to talk on the phone.
Gabby ran over to the toys.
Annika, David answered, sounding chipper and cheery. I was just going to call you.
Because your email doesn't work?
No worries, I've got a pen. You can dictate it to me. Ha, that's actually kind of funny.
I'm a real gas.
Where's the story, David?
David could picture Annika scowl by the tone of her voice. She was 50-something, fit and slim from running and Pilates, with shoulder-length blonde hair. Poor Annika walked under a black cloud. Everywhere she went, it was raining deadlines, and David was only adding to her misery. He'd make it up to her. A bottle of Chianti, and she'd forget this little lapse. She owed him a pass anyway. His first story for her was supposed to have been a puff piece about a bright foster kid from Lowell who won some creative writing contest. The 1,500 words she asked for turned into a high-impact story that ran over several days and exposed a huge scandal involving the Department of Children and Families. David could always tell where the real story was, and he knew this particular assignment should not be about one triumphant Marine.
The story is in progress, David said.
Have you interviewed Sergeant Thompson yet?
Sergeant Jesse Thompson was a Balearica native who'd lost an arm to an IED and was helping other vets overcome their PTSD symptoms with some success.
Almost.
How can you almost interview somebody?
I've thought about calling him, but I'm working on a different angle right now.
David was more interested in the staggering numbers of vets with PTSD. The problem was approaching epidemic levels, with 1 out of 4 servicemen and women returning from combat significantly different.
This isn't the New York Times, Annika said. We're a local paper. We've never won a Pulitzer, and I don't think my boss really cares if we do.
Never say never, David responded.
Annika sighed.
How much longer do you need?
Small community paper or not, he and his boss were still cut from the same stock. Both of them wanted to do good work, important journalism. If a story were here, Annika would want David to find it.
Give me a couple weeks. Sergeant Thompson isn't going anywhere. We can do a flashy piece on him anytime, but I want to explore this a little bit more.
You're thinking series.
He pursed his lips. The phone's not ringing to send me back to Syria.
What's your plan?
I'm going to talk to some vets, the guys who haven't been helped.
Give me some names.
Testing to make sure David was actually working. Luckily, he had his notes handy.
How about I give you 3, David said. William Byrd, Max Soucy, and Adam Bryant.
Click. Annika had hung up without a goodbye. It was David's signal to get to work. Chapter 10. The house hadn't changed much since Carrie left for college. The wall-to-wall carpeting had long ago been replaced with hardwood flooring, and Carrie's bedroom had been converted into a guest room, but those were minor adjustments. Everything here, down to the round oak table in the kitchen, was familiar. The framed pictures on the walls reflected a close-knit family. Usually they filled her with nostalgia, but today they made Carrie think about Leon Dixon. How many memories had Carrie erased with her mistake? Carrie broke free of such painful, paralyzing thoughts to look at photos of herself and Adam through various life stages. She especially loved the vacation pictures. Some photos recorded ski trips to the mountains of New Hampshire and Maine. Others showed their European adventures. A few had been taken in the Caribbean, and one displayed Howard and Adam riding elephants side by side on an African safari. There were probably as many photographs of Puckles, the shaggy and much-beloved family dog who had died a few years back, as there were of the kids. Carrie had encouraged her father to go to the shelter for another animal, but Howard quoted the comedian Louis C.K., who called puppies a countdown to sorrow. Carrie noticed Adam's military portraits were missing. In their place, Carrie's mom had hung a couple landscapes she painted herself. Carrie was impressed by her mother's latent artistic ability, though Irene credited her teacher for her rapid progress. After some time, Carrie wandered into the kitchen, where Howard was warming up the soup. Her dad had a full head of hair, but it was more gray than brown, and thinning. Carrie's mom had once bought him a color treatment, but Howard never opened the box.
Vanity is a young man's game, he'd say. Steam from two hot mugs of green tea fogged up the glasses on Howard's round face, magnifying two of the kindest eyes Carrie had ever seen.
Your mom will be home in a bit, but you and I can catch up.
When the soup was ready, Howard sat at the table. Carrie joined him. The tea was a perfect temperature, and the soup smelled savory and delicious. Carrie had been living off cafeteria food for so long she'd all but forgotten what home cooking tasted like. She took a sip of tea.
Your hands are shaking, her father said. I know it's hard to see your brother like this.
Carrie set her tea down. It's not just Adam, Dad. Dad. The word was a safety net. It allowed Carrie to let everything out. Her eyes closed tight, a sob escaping, and tears streamed down her cheeks. Howard pulled his chair close and put his arms around her.
What's going on, honey?
Carrie took a few ragged breaths. Something really awful happened. It was not an easy story to tell. For most of it, Carrie struggled to get the words out. At first, she cried a lot, breathing hard, short of breath. But eventually, she settled and managed to tell it all. Howard looked impressed as Carrie recounted Beth's surgery and the DIC episode. Details about Leon's surgery were fuzzier, perhaps because Carrie had blocked them out, but she remembered Dr. Metcalf's worried expression as he tried to locate the tumor. Howard did not flinch when Carrie revealed her mistake. His eyes held no trace of judgment. He was full of compassion when she told him about the meeting that followed and her resignation. Carrie could not have asked for a better confidant. Her father had spent years honing his listening skills. He had long believed that what a patient said and how they said it was sometimes more telling than the actual examination. These were skills that he had imparted to his daughter, and they'd been working well. But even Howard, who always seemed to know just the right thing to say, looked at a loss for words. In the prolonged silence that followed Carrie's story, he poured them both more tea. I've let everyone down, Carrie said, an all-too-familiar tightness creeping back into her chest.
Sweetheart, right now is not the time for advice or instruction. Just know I am here for you, and your mother is too. And in a way, so is Adam. We love you, and we'll stand by you through all of this.
Carrie embraced her father again, and Howard kissed the top of her head.
Tell me what you need. Anything.
Carrie laughed because she could not believe what she was about to ask.
With my student loans and no income, I just don't have the money to afford my apartment. Not without a job.
Howard nodded.
I can lend you whatever you need. Mom and I can cover your rent for a while.
Carrie shook off that idea.
Some doctor I turned out to be. I'm 29 years old, and I need my parents to pay my rent.
No, thank you.
Don't let your pride get in your way. Think of it as a loan.
Carrie tossed her hands in the air.
It's not pride. It's practicality. How am I going to repay it? She asked. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm completely lost here.
Then don't repay it.
Carrie shook her head again. I can't accept that. Not without a plan. It wouldn't feel right to me. I might not even want to stay in town. Maybe I need to go get a research job, something in academia. I don't know.
Then, what do you want to do in the interim?
Carrie sensed her father already knew. Again, her thoughts went to Adam. They had taken two different paths and yet found themselves at the same destination. It must be discouraging for her father to have worked so hard to raise independent children, only to have them turn out unable to function in the world.
I spoke to my landlord, Carrie said. He'll let me break my lease and give me my deposit back.
That's fine, but where are you going to go? Howard asked.
Carrie shrugged and tried not to look so crestfallen.
I'd like to move back here for a bit, if that's okay with you and Mom. At least until I figure out my next step.
Howard put his hand over Carrie's.
This is your home, sweetheart, he said. It'll always be your home.
Chapter 11
Carrie glanced out the sidelight window at an unfamiliar car, a Zipcar rental, parked in the driveway. The Bryants hadn't had many visitors in the 2 weeks since Carrie had moved home. No one had rung the bell, so whoever it was must have come to see Adam.
Good.
Carrie was still in her pajamas and didn't feel like making small talk. Since she'd gotten home, she'd done next to nothing except watch old movies with her dad. She wasn't feeling cute, clean, or the least bit congenial, hardly ready to face the outside world. For all the recent tumult, coming home had been seamless. Adam had helped with the move, such as it was. The U-Haul truck she had rented was far too big for her few possessions. Everything Carrie owned, a futon, 2 bookcases, 3 boxes of books, mostly medical texts, and some fiction. A flea market coffee table, a small color television and scuffed TV stand, some clothes, a few framed pictures, and a dresser fit into a small corner of her parents' basement. It was depressing to realize her life's accumulations could take up so little space. For so long, her focus had been on nothing but medicine. Carrie wondered what could possibly take its place. Carrie had settled in her old bedroom, but it was far from cozy or comforting. Limbic, Carrie's goldfish, swam unfazed in his large bowl, which rested atop the same blue dresser she'd had as a kid. It was still her childhood bedroom, even with all her old memorabilia boxed up, and the twin bed covered in the emerald-green Tibetan quilt Carrie had bought on her travels to the Far East. Living here again was dispiriting, though better than living in Boston with her parents paying the rent. Stress had triggered insomnia, which in turn triggered a new dependence on Ambien that left her perpetually exhausted. Her runs, if they could be called runs, were uninspired and dangerously close to being brisk walks. She was probably clinically depressed, but Carrie wasn't going to get help for it. She didn't deserve to feel better. Carrie's actions had substantially reduced Leon's quality of life. It was unclear whether his symptoms would improve over time. Carrie deserved to feel lousy. Carrie's mother, Irene, a petite 60-year-old woman, entered the foyer through the dining room, rubbing lotion on her hands. She was dressed in a blue denim shirt and khaki pants, the uniform of a passionate gardener.
"Who's here?" Carrie asked. "A reporter from the Lowell Observer," Irene said. "He's here to interview Adam for a story."
Carrie's eyes narrowed.
"Adam?"
Since his discharge from the WTC, Adam preferred solitude. Friends rarely came over. This guest was a surprise to her.
Irene said, "I got a call from Everett Barnes, the director of Veteran Outreach for the Home Base Program, asking to see if Adam would tell his story. I told him about it, and I guess he agreed."
Carrie understood now. Home Base had been set up by the Red Sox Foundation to give clinical care and support services to Iraq and Afghanistan service members, veterans, and their families all through New England. It dealt specifically with veterans and their families affected by stress or traumatic brain injuries sustained on deployment or in combat. Sadly, the organization could not grow fast enough.
"I'll go see how it's going," Irene said,
pushing her bangs off her forehead and tucking a strand of dark, shoulder-length hair behind her ear.
"Oh, and your father is in the kitchen. He wants to speak with you."
Carrie found her dad sitting at the kitchen table, sipping from a mug of steaming coffee. He drank his coffee no frills. The whole family did. Was this learned or inherited? Carrie poured herself a cup.
"You wanted to speak with me?"
Howard's face tensed. Carrie ignored a tick of anxiety and sat down, preparing herself for anything.
"I've been thinking about things," Howard began, choosing each word carefully. "And I think you've come too far to quit now."
Carrie folded her arms and looked away, her instinct for self-preservation kicking in. This felt like an ambush. She had made it abundantly clear that reconsideration was not an option. To be a great surgeon required great confidence, and Carrie would be a danger in the OR. Still, this was her dad, and the soul of kindness. He deserved that she sit still and listen.
"You are a gifted neurosurgeon," he continued, "with only one more year to complete your residency. I know that you had your heart set on that fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic, and then who knows what. I don't want to say something trite, like everybody makes mistakes, but I honestly can't think of one successful person, especially not doctors, who hasn't gone through a personal hell of some sort or another. Sleepless nights, a crisis of confidence. Not one.
He picked up his coffee cup again and took a long drink. Carrie's voice caught and came out a bit shaky. Contradicting her father had never come easily.
Dad, you don't know how badly Leon is hurt. Honestly, just the thought of operating makes me anxious. I was never this way before.
Howard nodded. His eyes brimmed with empathy.
I know, he said. You've said that many times. But there's something I never told you that I think you should hear.
He shifted in his chair.
When I was an intern, I accidentally overdosed a young man suffering from a seizure.
Carrie said nothing. In the silence, the revelation became its own uncomfortable presence.
I gave him too much phenobarbital. I'll never forget it. He stopped breathing and his blood pressure collapsed. We had to call the code, and the poor guy almost died. Because of me. Because of my mistake. I saw him every day in the ICU for the next week, and each time I was racked with terrible, terrible guilt. Even today, I always double-check myself when I administer drugs, her father said. Especially that drug.
Carrie could relate. The last she heard, Beth Stillwell had recovered and returned to work. But Leon had been transferred to a long-term nursing care facility. Not all of Leon's deficits were attributed to Carrie's mistake, but she'd owned all the guilt regardless.
Unlike Leon, my patient was going to get entirely better before I made him worse, her father continued. For weeks, I couldn't sleep, barely could eat. Thankfully, he did recover, but I think he kept my point. My mistake almost cost this man his life. But that's a part of the job. We're expected to be perfect, but no human being is infallible. Not you, not me, not Dr. Metcalf. Mistakes happen. But it's how we deal with the adversity that defines our character. You can make peace with this and find a way to move forward. I did. Now, I've got a suggestion.
Carrie could guess where he was going with all this, but it was too soon. Too soon. She could not pick up another scalpel. Not now, and despite what he said, maybe not ever.
You're a grown woman, and these are ultimately your decisions. But I have some years and some perspective, so I ask only that you hear me out. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a dinner on Parkinson's disease, sponsored by a pharmaceutical company. I sat next to a man who was taking their drug, a patient. Turns out he had deep brain stimulation to help his treatment, and now, with the combination of DBS and his meds, he's doing better. He was able to attend meetings like this one.
Carrie knew all about DBS, a surgical treatment involving the implantation of a brain pacemaker and wires that delivered electrical impulses to targeted areas of the brain. It was used to treat movement disorders such as Parkinson's, but researchers and clinicians were exploring other applications, including treatments for OCD, major depression, and chronic pain.
This man was very pleased with his results, Howard said. He talked at great length about his treatment at the VA under Dr. Alistair Finley, whom I know from way back when I did my internship. I haven't seen him since, but why don't you go talk with him? He's right in town. Use my name. We weren't especially close, but I'm sure he'd remember me.
Thanks, Dad, Carrie said. I'll give it some thought. She turned her coffee cup in her hands. I'm not particularly interested in Parkinson's. I mean, that's not what we really do in neurosurgery. Howard conceded with a nod.
I understand it may seem less glamorous, but maybe, given your reluctance to get back in the saddle, it could be just what the doctor ordered.
Carrie smiled. She was about to tease him about dads being doctors when the doorbell rang. Howard got up to see who was there. A moment later, Carrie heard him exclaim, "Oh my gosh!" Howard returned to the kitchen with a tall, lanky man who was bleeding profusely from his nose. The oily rag he was using to staunch the flow had smeared a good portion of his face with engine grease.
Adam apparently took offense to something.
Howard spoke without emotion. He'd long since realized it didn't help to get upset about his son's new hair-trigger temper.
Could you please get this gentleman some ice? I'm going to go look for your mother and my boy.
Carrie took the stranger by the arm and led him to a chair at the kitchen table. Tilt your head back, she said once he was seated.
He looked like a boxer ready to concede the fight.